ahead and start. For those of you who didn't read the little blurb, I'll tell you a little bit about myself and background to this project that we're going to be talking about this week. My name is Mark Marenko. I've been teaching philosophy at Pacific University, which is not Pacific Lutheran University, but it's Pacific University, which is about 35-40 minute drive from downtown Portland west. So we're on the way to the ocean. Pacific University is a small liberal arts college attached to 7 health professional programs. And I've been teaching there since 1988, so quite some time. And in the year 2000, we began something called the Pacific Institute for Ethics and Social Policy. And this was an attempt by our university to kind of reach out to the community, to bring the resources of the university into the community and address issues of substantial, persistent, often highly controversial concern. And the two areas that we spend most of our time on are the impact of national security policy and for law enforcement and other people who are affected, immigration issues, we talk about these things as well, and then healthcare issues. And the biggest subject that we talk about there is genetics. And just to give you a little bit of background there on the project, in the year 2005, we received what was for us an enormous amount of money, and we were surprised by this, from the National Institutes of Health. Sometimes I think they think that the United States sort of ends with the Mississippi, and that money doesn't flow out here quite enough from that organization. But in this case, they gave us $257,000 to do a 2-year project that we called Faith Forum on Genetics. We began working with the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and worked with 21 different denominations, faith-oriented groups. When we first applied to the National Institutes of Health, it was kind of comical in retrospect. We did not get it first time around. They were very encouraging, said you must reapply, we really want you to get this. But we looked at the reviews, and here was one reviewer said, we can't fund this project, there's no diversity here. This is all for Christians. It's not for any other religious group but Christians. How can the NIH fund something that's just for one religious group? Then we got another reviewer's report said, we can't fund this project. It's impossible. There's no way that you're going to be able to do a project with this much diversity. 21 different denominations you're talking about, including perhaps Jehovah's Witness or Mormons and the Unitarians. How are you going to manage that diversity? So we basically rewrote the project, showed them those two reviews, and say, this time around we want to deal with roughly what we know, and then maybe branch out into what we don't know later. And they were very happy with the grant. One religious group, by the way, which might be of interest to you, started the project and dropped out. And do you have any idea what the religious community it might be? As soon as their leadership kind of found out that we were doing this, they said, we don't want you involved in this project. We consider it actually dangerous for our participants, our parishioners.
Scientology.
No, the Scientology, we didn't even think to invite them.
Fair enough.
Pardon? No, they did a good job. Actually, we had two LDS physicians facilitating the group. It turned out to be a good group.
Christian
Science. You say Christian Science.
I
okay, so you get an extra dessert. Christian Science. And why do you think that might be?
Medical.
Pardon?
Because of the medical field participation?
It's yes, but very specific. Something very specific. We were dealing with genetic testing. They did not want their parishioners to even consider the possibility of taking a genetic test, because to consider the possibility could potentially create the condition that they're afraid will show up in the test. You see what I'm saying? That the very spiritual, it's a spiritual act to do this. And so the leadership pulled the plug on the Christian Scientists, so we weren't able to do it with them. Everyone else was on board.
Did you get the Catholics?
Yeah, the Catholics. We had to, you know, talk with the archdiocese and show them our materials, but they were happy and went on board once we did.
Did the NIH fund the grant?
Yes, $257,000 they funded, and I'll explain why in a minute. But I was going to say one thing. Oh, it's surprisingly, you think about different groups in different ways, and perhaps we have prejudice about groups just like we have prejudice about classes of people and so on, religious communities. And we had from Unitarians on one end, sort of the spectrum, who were uncomfortable when we were talking about Christianity at all, you know, in some of the materials and so on. And, you know, we had the Southern Baptists as well there, and the Quakers were there. Which group do you imagine we had the most difficulty with? Just in terms of contentiousness and the kind of fighting with themselves and kind of need for... It was the Unitarians. I was surprised by this. And the group that had the most, that worked the best together and ended up really using this whole project to their benefit within their religious community, their community of faith, with the Quakers. They were unbelievable. They were right on top of it. The science curriculum was the hardest part to sell to people, because many people, you know, they flunk out biology in high school and they think that they can't get it, so they've got this mental block. I'm looking at my daughter here. She sometimes thinks she has a phobia that she's good at it. She doesn't realize how good she is. Then they end up thinking they can't get it, and so they just won't do the science curriculum of the project, right? So we were keen. That then leads me to explain a little bit about how it is that we got this this grant, which is kind of surprising. Way back in 1989, when the Congress decided to fund the Human Genome Project, fund the NIH for the Human Genome Project, James Watson stood up, and he's turned out to be kind of a loose cannon, a controversial figure himself. He's a good example of a person who's really brilliant in one field, deciding he's really brilliant in all fields, and ends up talking about stuff he just doesn't know anything about. But anyway, to his credit, he stood up in Congress and said, you know, look, there's going to be a lot of money put into research here on the Human Genome Project, and probably more than any other kind of scientific endeavor, this is going to produce more public controversy than anything else. And so we need to set aside 3% of this budget to fund projects which will basically address the science, but also the ethics. It's called the ELSI program, the Ethical, Legal, and Social Issues program in the NIH, to basically help mediate the conversations that were going to be needed if the science was going to be turned into technology that would then be useful and understood and accepted by the culture. So they not only agreed with Watson on this, they ended up doubling that portion of the budget. They also targeted in the request for proposals communities of faith. They thought that communities of faith were going to be an especially sensitive demographic for the kinds of issues that would be addressed or would be raised by doing the science. And I was told that they were having some trouble finding suitable principal investigators, they call them, for this kind of intervention, they call it. And so they would either end up with people applying who were so deeply embedded within a religious tradition that they were afraid that they had an agenda, a theological agenda perhaps, or they were ending up getting proposals by people who didn't know how to speak faith, who didn't know how to communicate with communities of faith. They kind of saw in my background, I have a Master of Divinity degree from Yale, and I have my philosophy degree from Oxford, and so at least the appearances were that there was some kind of possibility here for doing a project that would sincerely address the actual issues that were within the communities of faith and be understood and trusted by people within communities of faith, but nevertheless be able to do the kind of ethics and science and so on in a responsible way. The other thing that I think was attractive to them was the fact that we took the science real seriously. We decided that we weren't going to do the ethics till we got some science involved there. And in fact, I'll pass around. I needed to have these back. I'll just pass these around here. We came up with a kind of Wikipedia type dictionary on genetic science, color coded with green, yellow, and red. So green are terms that we think every educated person or every person who reads a newspaper has to have this level of understanding about genetics. Yellow is, if you're intrigued by the green terms, you know, you might want to spend a little more time on the yellow. And then the red's the real tough stuff that no one really needs or has to know to be able to understand what's going on in the papers. But, you know, it's there if you want it. Then there's also a sort of a Wikipedia type of glossary of terms in theology, ethics, and philosophy in the back of this as well. We took the science seriously, and a good illustration of what the benefit of that was we had a grant before this, a much smaller grant, to work with two African American communities in Portland area. And they in fact were a very difficult group for us to earn their trust for a lot of good historical reasons. But once we were in, we're treated like family. And we ended up in the basement of a church in Northeast Portland every week, you know, over a period of 7 weeks. And it was absolutely packed. These were all people who had worked all day. And then come and listen to us talk about genetics. And then we did a little survey and came and discovered that we couldn't find a single person there who believed that the technology would ever actually benefit them. And yet they felt an obligation to understand it enough to speak about it and think about it. But we did the science. And that was one of the most great, they were the most grateful about that part of it, because they felt like for the first time they could read an article in the paper, understand what an allele is, or the difference between dominant and recessive gene traits, and homozygous versus heterozygous gene traits, and so on. And so they were really impressed with that part of it. But also, it turns out, and that's going to be the case tonight if you don't know the science, that with the science comes a kind of moral responsibility, actually, just to have the knowledge of it, if you think about it. And I remember that when Lisa Sardinia, who did the science part of it, sat down, and I stood up and I said, I'm serious when I say to you, I look you in the eye and say, you really truly may wish you did not know what you just learned after we're finished with the conversation tonight. You know, you start to hear a pin drop. They were really, you know, what have we done, you know, now that we know this stuff, what is it? And the reason is very simple, that once you know, or know that you can know, you're as morally accountable for choosing not to know as to know, right? And that was a very powerful experience that, I think the NIH was happy with the results of that. So anyway, that's basically the story that leads up to what we're going to be doing tonight. This was an ELSI grant, Ethical, Legal, Social Issues grant, especially targeted towards communities of faith, called Faith Forum on Genetics. Okay, so let's see here. First, I wanted to talk just briefly, if I could, about technology. There's a guy I like, actually a guy named Neil Postman, a media critic. He's died now, but he says that with any technology, we need to ask 5 questions. Because with the introduction of any technology into our lives, whether it's a cell phone, an iPod, the internet, or any kind of an innovation, that these things are true of that technological assertion, you know, into our culture. One is that there's always a trade-off. That, and I think many of us understand this with the internet especially, and email especially. You know, that somehow the technology, the way that we do it is very, well, it's very un-Amish, that's for sure. That is to say, we tend to let the technology drag us around by the nose. That we tend to let technology just see what it can do and then adjust to what it can do. And that actually makes a difference in how we live our lives. It makes a difference in our capacities. There's a lot of research on multitasking and so on and what this does to us. So there's always a trade-off, and unfortunately, these trade-offs aren't apparent until it's often too late to make informed decisions about the technology. Secondly, advantages and disadvantages of new technologies are never distributed evenly among the population. There's going to be people who are going to benefit from a technology and people who are not going to benefit, and maybe even be disadvantaged by the technology. Embedded in every technology, and we'll talk about this tonight in terms of faith, especially in terms of faith tonight, there is a powerful idea, sometimes two or three powerful ideas. Fourth, technological change is not additive, it is ecological. That's what I was saying before, in a sense, that it's not like you think of a, you know, a drop of ink in water, right? It doesn't just float down to the bottom. It dissipates throughout the culture. It changes the culture. It changes the way we think about ourselves, our expectations, and the way we relate to each other. Whether it's the invention of writing, which I'll talk about in a minute, or the invention of the internet, it changes us. Of course, Neil Postman was a big anti-TV critic. He wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which I highly recommend. And so, for example, a good example here, I think, is he said, Sesame Street never taught any kid to love education. It taught them to love television. And that ever since Sesame Street, says it changed fundamentally the way that teachers think about what they need to do to be teachers. Right? That's his thesis, and he argues for it, whether you agree with it or not. That's not our discussion tonight, so I'm not going to argue with you. So the last part is technology tends to become mythic. And what mythic here is a special sociological term that has to do with the idea that the technology tends to become something which we think of almost as a part of nature at some point. The television. For example, we don't own a television set. People look at us, it's not as though they drop, it's like, did I hear it? Did I understand? You don't have a television? What do you mean? It's like some basic expectation of people. End up having as a sort of a basic human right. A good example is my daughter, who's 15. On her 15th birthday, it was assumed that she would have a what?
A cell phone.
Of course, a cell phone. As though it were a basic human right, fundamental to all teenagers, that at some point they get a cell phone, and it's here. You know, they have it. That's their cell phone. It's part of getting dressed. Right? So technology tends to become mythic. Now, what Postman is saying, that for all these reasons, we should do more of what the Amish do. Find some way to have critique commensurate with the seriousness of the changes that the technology produces in us. This whole project is part of is trying to do that with genetics, is we've got decisions to make that most people really don't understand that we're even having to make, let alone being able to make them in an informed way, particularly around genetic testing. And I imagine there's people in this room who've already been affected by, in some way, genetic tests, either your family or you or friends. All right, here, just as I just love this quote. Oh, sure. So here, I just love the quote from Plato. Okay, this is about writing, all right? So he says, to this famous reply, Thuth, my paragon of inventors, the discoverer of an art, James Watson, please pay attention, the discoverer of an art is not the best judge of the good or harm which will accrue to those who practice it. So it is in this, you who are the father of writing, you know, we love our libraries, writing, have out of the fondness of your offspring attributed to it quite the opposite of its real function. Those who acquire it will cease to exercise their memory. They will become forgetful. They will rely on writing to bring things to their remembrance by external signs instead of their own internal resources. Every time I read this, I'm compelled by it, but don't know what to do with it. What you have discovered is a recipe, receipt for recollection, not for memory. And as for wisdom, your pupils will have the reputation for it without the reality. They will receive a quantity of information without proper instruction. Read times a billion the internet. And in consequence be thought very knowledgeable when they are, for the most part, quite ignorant. And because they are filled with the conceit of wisdom, instead of real wisdom, they will be a burden to society. Okay? So if we then move this to technology, no one doubts that technology, genetic technologies, can and will and are, in fact, producing real social goods. Just a tiny little example. This is all the way back 2005. Rapid genetic testing for eye disease. Why is that important? Retinitis pigmentosa. It's a disease that produces blindness and progressive blindness. You have a diagnosis. There's all these symptoms. You come to a conclusion that this is what the person has. If you then add genetics to the equation, what you find out is that you have five, perhaps six different diseases that have all the same symptoms that we call retinitis pigmentosa if you look at the phenotypes, or the genotypes rather than the phenotype, right? So that's going to be important to what? Treatment. So pharmacy companies are really interested in genetics so that they can target drugs to specific genetic profiles that will be effective in the treatment of these really crude terms now that we use called diagnosis without the genetic background, right? So on the one hand, we have that. On the other hand, we have some pretty bizarre things. Here's a New York Times magazine when Ian Wilmot, you know, cloned Dolly and so on, that there's going to be people who are going to want to clone themselves and so on. And there is a religious group called the Raelians, R-A-E-L-I-A-N, the Raelians, who do have a cadre of women who are lined up, ready to give birth to the first human clone. Will it happen? Of course it will. Of course it will. If you can clone mammals, we're mammals, the likelihood of it happening is very, very high. Then this also produces some kind of, you know, this is a humorous way of talking about the possibility of crossing species, you know, putting genetic material from one species into the germline of another. Yeah, we laugh, we look at this and laugh at this, but the Oregon Primate Center in Oregon, there's a non-human primate named Andy, which is inserted DNA, spelled backwards, A-N-D-I, that they inserted jellyfish gene into the germline that was coded to produce a protein that glows green. And they succeeded. This is, the old ideal of the chimera, the idea of a chimera, of crossing species, being able to have cross species. Why do you imagine they did that, by the way? What would be the point of putting a jellyfish gene into a non-human? Why do you suppose they did that?
You can see when it's expressed.
Yeah, perfect. Well, but for what purpose?
As a test for if it's a non-human grade ape. If it works in a non-human grade ape, it should then work in a human.
That's one of the reasons for it.
See if it can pass on to the next generation.
To see if they can do it and then perhaps apply it. Another reason is that if they can do this, they can also insert human genes, enough of them, to give them susceptibility to diseases that they would then be legally allowed to do testing on, research on. Do you think PETA is interested in this? In other words, yeah, it's a big, so you have all those ethical issues as well. We're going to talk about this, I think, on Wednesday more. So there's James Watson, Francis Crick, 1953, year after I was born, who discovered the double helix. There's some controversy whether they really did, by the way, but they might be somebody else that they kind of title to it. But they're the ones that are the sort of the icons for the discovery. Now we're going to do just a little bit of science here. Oh, boy. Sorry. Time is not my friend. Just really quickly here. that, you know, there's trillions of cells in the human body. All of them have nuclei. And in within that, they have chromosomes, along which we have 2 meters worth of this this substance called DNA. And there's 3 billion DNA subunits, and they all are can be represented in these 4 letters, A, T, C, and G. That's it, the whole thing. Every cell in your body has these strands. T's always go with A's, C's always go with G's, and they do this so that they can produce a blueprint, RNA, to be able to produce proteins. And it turns out that there's far fewer genes that are functioning genes that have a specific purpose in our DNA than they thought. There's only 30,000. At first they were predicting something like 100,000. Turns out there's only around 30. Now here's the next part here is that they come in triplets called a codon, so that each 3 series here produces a specific amino acid. And there's 20 of them. These are the basic building blocks. And in a sequence, in this case here, right, you see this sequence of amino acids, it then produces a protein. And our whole body then is made up of the production of these proteins that have specific functions within the body. So, for example, we had our nice dinner tonight, and we ate our food, we began chewing it, we produced saliva. And our saliva is a protein that produces an enzyme that begins the digestive process. In that part of the body, that's all the cells do. Nevertheless, all the cells have all of the DNA. What happens is it's called differentiation. The DNA folds over on itself. It stops certain kinds of genes from being expressed and only allows a certain gene to be expressed. In this case, the protein that produces the enzyme for digestion. Right? Now, here's what can go wrong when we have something called a mutation. And while I'm giving this talk, hundreds, if not thousands, of mutations are taking place in our body. They happen all the time. Let's see, and is that you've got, what happens is that occasionally, for whatever reason, you'll have a mistake made in one of the series here. And in this case, you'll see that the A turning to a G doesn't change the amino acid, doesn't change it. However, over here, the G changing to an A, or the R changing to an A, changing to an A here, produces a different amino acid, and it ends up creating a protein that's dysfunctional. It does something it's not supposed to do, and you have a problem. Do you know Huntington's disease? It's a terrible genetic disorder, and it has to do with a repeating triplet that gets out of control there, and it produces then an excess of a particular protein that inevitably then produces the disease. There's another way of describing the same thing. And here's an actual photograph of chromosomes. And Huntington's, I believe, is on chromosome 4. Breast cancer 17 and I think 14, those two, is where the gene is. Culture. This is Salvador Dali, 1963. And this is his wife, Gayla. And he actually put his own name and hers in the title here, misspells diribonucleic acid, and then an homage to Crick and Watson. This is actually a structure for salt for some reason, and they are actually turbaned individuals with rifles pointing at each other's head. And we have God here reaching down, and there's actually, you can't see it too well, there's a Christ figure there who's being drawn up into heaven. There's blood coming out here. When Salvador Dali spoke with James Watson, he said to him, "You restored my belief in the existence of a God, the discovery of DNA, just restored my belief in the existence of God." James Watson turned around and said, "That's interesting, it did the exact opposite for me." So it's interesting how you can have the same set of facts and people look at them and absorb them differently. They mean different things. I would like to show, I'm running out of time so fast I didn't realize. I want to show this little film clip here in the culture of 1930s. Anyone, Myrna Loy? Is that name familiar to anybody? This is a comedy. William Powell, Myrna Loy, The Thin Man series. Here's a little clip from The Thin Man. You probably didn't expect to see this in Electron Genetics. Watch this, 1930s.
All I know is that I want you to marry me right now.
I can't marry you. I can never marry you.
Dorothy.
I'd like to have a couple of little murderers here, too. That'd be fun, wouldn't it? Perhaps they'd all murder each other and keep it in the family. That's what Father should have done. He should have killed Gilbert and me, and then we wouldn't have had all this to go through.
Dorothy, you're talking like a crazy person.
Why not? I am crazy. All our family's crazy.
Dorothy, listen to me. I love you. Do you understand that? I love you.
Tommy, Tommy. Please go.
You know, you're wrong about all of your children being murderers. Now, I've studied the Mendelian law of inheritance and their experiments with sweet peas. And according to their findings, and they've been pretty conclusive, only one out of four of your children will be a murderer. No, that might not work. First, it might be the bad one. I'll have to look that up.
Oh, you need to bother looking that up. I'm not going to get married, and I'm not going to have any children. From now on, I'm just out for the ride.
Yeah, yeah, all right. I just love that. Well, let's see if I can get back to where we're supposed to be here from current slide. So anyway, certainly produces lots of problems with the map. So I just wanted to say, just that in the 1930s, before DNA was even discovered, they understood that the consequences of what they were learning about inheritance might be able to be applied to social problems, right? So here he was saying, you know, the 1 in 4 chance of just have 3 kids and you'll be okay. The big book under his arm, those beautiful, I think the Army calls them birth control glasses, you know, the Woody Allen type of glasses. So you have all that there already in the 30s. You know, I mean, it just stuns me. So, and it does produce all of these problems, and I'm going to go through this very quickly because I do want, there's Ian Wilmot, by the way, who cloned Dolly in 1996, and his embryologist in Edinburgh. So anyway, what I want to do, because we are running out of time, when am I supposed to end? 7:15? Oh, okay, I'm have more time than I thought, so this is good. What I want to do is show you a clip that we're going to discuss tomorrow, and I'm actually going to pass out the transcript of this clip, because we're going to look at it very closely. This is, go from the 1930s, and Myrna Loy and William Powell, to 1996, 97, I can't remember when Gattaca came out. How many of you have seen Gattaca? Just a few of you. Okay, let me just say a couple things about it. It's a crummy movie from an acting, I don't know, I didn't like the movie and the acting in it so much, but it was amazing in terms of its projecting out the tension between two completely different futures, right? That where the technology will take us socially, scientifically, and what the implications of the science are. It centers around two brothers, right? One is born through a reproductive process known as sexual intercourse. And it's sort of the old-fashioned way, and what it turns out to be in this new world, and think about this one, it's called Russian roulette, and it's stupid. It's irresponsible. It's not, once you have the power, I told you, once you understand the science, that you have the power and the knowledge to stop playing roulette with reproduction, what parent is going to decide to have a kid the old-fashioned way? That's the challenge that we're going to talk about tonight and tomorrow. Then there's the other brother, who is sort of, the couple are trying to redeem themselves from this mistake that they made here in this car with the first birth. And they go in for a genetic counselor, and this is what the scene is this process of them going into the genetic counselor to produce their second child, and the sort of logic that led them to this decision. And I ask you to pay special attention to the couple as they look here, and the couple as you'll see them at the end of this clip. This is about human reproduction. It says newborn and preimplantation screening issues. It's much bigger than that. So here's the clip.
I was conceived in the Riviera, not the French Riviera, the Detroit variety. They used to say that a child conceived in love has a greater chance of happiness. They don't say that anymore. never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's all that used to matter. Not now. Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
Neurological condition, 60% probability. Manic depression, 42% probability. Attention deficit disorder, 89% probability. Heart disorder, 99% probability. Early fatal potential. Life expectancy, 30.2 years.
30 years.
The name of the certificate?
Anton?
No, Vincent Anton.
From an early age, I came to think of myself as others thought of me, chronically ill. Every skinned knee and runny nose was treated as if it were life-threatening.
I'm sorry, the insurance won't cover it. If he fell...
But I was told that everything was...
I really wish there was something I could do.
Like most other parents of their day, they were determined that their next child would be brought into the world in what has become the natural way.
Your extracted eggs, Marie, have been fertilized with Antonio's sperm. After screening, they're left, as you see, with 2 healthy boys and 2 very healthy girls. Naturally, no critical predispositions to any of the major inheritable diseases. All that remains is to select the most compatible candidate. First, we may as well decide on gender. Have you given it any thought?
We would want Vincent to have a brother, you know, play with.
Of course you would. Hello, Vincent. You have specified hazel eyes, dark hair, fairs. Yeah. I've taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions. Premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism, addictive susceptibility, domestic violence, obesity.
We didn't want, I mean, diseases, yes, but...
Right, we were just wondering if it's good to just leave a few things to chance.
You want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have enough imperfection built in already. Your child isn't needing additional burdens. And keep in mind, this child is still you. Simply the best of you. You could conceive naturally 1,000 times and never get such a result.
Whoa. I got the transcript. And I'm going to pass it around. So, I mean, the first thing I learned from this clip, that if you're going to conceive in a car, this has got to be the best. That's a great car.
It actually doesn't work. They must have built a platform over the back seat.
All right, so, but there's a sense in which, depending on your understanding of faith, that decision in the beginning to have sexual intercourse out of love with the intent to have a child, and that saying that a child conceived in love is more likely to be happy than one not, can be conceived as a kind of an act of faith, in a sense. And if you think about that image of them there, and contrast it with this couple, they're doing the same thing that they were doing in the car. But they're dressed, they're pensive, they're nervous, they need to be persuaded, and when the genetic counselor, who's bald and black, says, we've screened for things like, you know, premature baldness, and you specify fair skin, and then he gives the great big smile, you know. And then he says to me, we've taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions. They start listing them, and then what happens to them? He said, whoa, wait a minute. Is there any way that you can leave just something left to chance? It's as though this is the last pitiful distillate of whatever it was that led them to the act in the Riviera, right? This quest for some mystery, for their child to be some gift of the universe that they don't even know yet. And this is the last gasp of that kind of picture of reproduction, right? So let's just take a look at a closer look at this conversation, and tomorrow what we'll do is a case study built around some of the things that we saw in this clip. So let's say that you know them, you sit on an institutional review board, maybe you've gotten a little bit of a background, you know a little bit about the science and so on, and they're asking you to tell them what they should be doing. Should they get up and walk out of this scene? Should they continue with it? Did they really make a mistake by deciding to reproduce the old-fashioned way? And his words, I couldn't make it more clear. I never understood what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. And the African-American community that I told you about, we talked about this, and one of my concerns was that, many of them, they actually brought Bibles to the sessions that we had. My concern is that every question we raise, that they might start looking through to see if there would be some answer there that they could quickly give to the questions we raised. Boy, it was not the case at all. They really wrestled with, in this case, the concept of what faith is. And they seem to really have a really powerful, rich argument about this amongst themselves, what we were watching them. One view centering on the idea of mystery, of accepting what one has been given, of understanding that whatever we do, there's going to be suffering, not for us and for our children, that to be a parent isn't just to be about doing everything you can to protect your kids from all possible suffering, but to love them and be with them in the inevitable sufferings that go with being a human being, as opposed to a concept of faith that says, God gave us the science. Yeah, gave us the science, gave us the knowledge and the power. Faith means to act responsibly with that knowledge and power. But even that group of people who understood faith that way didn't know what to do with this clip. Didn't know whether or not the morally correct decision was to go forward with some kind of engineering, some kind of choice up front. So here's Alex Moran. He's a sociologist. It's claimed that our genome is important in a way that everything else isn't. The genome is construed as the ontological hard core of our being, the main determinant of our individual and species characteristics, with nothing left over. The necessary and sufficient cause that makes us us. We might call this the genetic myth. Myth here not meaning a false story, but a myth that informs, it's a narrative that informs us about ourselves somehow. It's a story about the gene. I'm not talking about true or false, I'm just saying that it's mythic in that sense. The genome has practically become the secular equivalent of the soul. So, here we go. Only seconds old is an obvious overstatement here. Exact time and cause of death is already known. This is a newborn screening. It's too late. It's too late, right, for Vincent. Even if we do not know, and by the way, did you notice there, just a moment, did you notice there, I love this thing, you just turn it off and you have to look at me. But did you notice that instantly, as soon as they did the readout, and they said, what's the name on the certificate? The father, whose name is Anton, right? Marie says Anton. She says, no, Vincent, that's a good name. And then he names his other kid Anton. And then immediately the mother, Marie, starts looking at her and petting the child in a way and says, you'll do something. Or already casting him as some poor creature who needs some special care because he's going to die when he's 30. Right? Mm-hmm. And it changes. The labeling changes the relationships instantly from birth. Okay, I'll turn it back on. And so when we're dealing with these, yeah, at least from the standpoint of more and more testing, there is a legal, there's going to be legal pressures to do so. Just think about this. You're a physician, prenatal, neonatal specialist. You are going to be dealing with counseling with your patients and so on. And now you've got all of these tests, over 1,000 of them, that you can do for genetic disorders. Some of them may be 1 in a billion chances, but there's the test, right? And then what you end up with are, and there have been a number of successful ones here, not just in this country, but other countries, where a couple ends up with a child who has a genetic defect, way out off the moon, somewhere off the moon. They don't know where it came from, so on and so forth. They find out the doctor could have recommended a test that would have revealed that. He didn't recommend that. Sue the doctor, sue the hospital, sue the any educational institutions that are connected with the hospital. And you end up with a wrongful birth suit. Okay? Wrongful life is different, something else. I don't know, spend time with it. Okay, neurological condition, manic depression, attention deficit, heart disorder, rapidly increasing range of types of conditions. Different sorts of, what do you want to call them? Calculus, right? You have this calculus you do, this formula you work out to kind of get the life expectancy out. And as we better understand the correlations between complex genetic patterns and disease, predispositions, disability, etc., the calculus will be more predictive. So we don't have the kind of predictive, you know, the kind of prediction we have in this clip, but we're moving in that direction. And there's no reason to think that increasingly refined science will give us increasing predictability with these things. Also notice here these terms and how pregnant they are, how loaded they are. What's the difference between a genetic disease, a genetic disorder, a genetic predisposition, a genetic trait? Call something genetic trait, you think one thing. Call it a disability, you think another. Right? So we are the ones who are giving shape and meaning to these conditions. Right? So newborn screening, it's too late for germline. They feel guilty about this. You can see. Name for the certificate, I already went through that, so you'll use something. And the insurance won't cover it. If you fell, you know, what is the meaning of insurance in the context of genetic science ultimately? It's the ultimate readout on pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. Does your insurance company like pre-existing conditions? You know? And they often will do medical histories, and as part of the insurance, talk about medical history, you know, genetic testing, screening. That's what you call medical history, going way back. And I'm on the genetics advisory board of the state legislature in Oregon, and we have very strong laws which these genetic tests can't be used as a basis for declining insurance and so on. But all the concepts and principles are in place. There's a couple of companies in Florida, for example, that will not hire someone who smokes. And now what I mean here is not, they won't hire someone who smokes but doesn't do it on the job. They do testing for a nicotine, right? And how did that come to be? Very simple equation. You ask everybody in the company, look, if we don't hire any smokers, do the actuarial tables. Guess what? Smoking is a bad thing. It's a very bad thing. Do the actuarial tables. What you end up with is a very simple equation. No one in this pool, company, smokes. Guess what? Everyone's premiums are going down. Do you want to vote for this? Yes or no? Should we exclude smokers from this company? Yes or no? Guess what they voted for, right? So if you extend that to screened and unscreened embryos and all this semen genetic testing, you begin to get the picture of where things could be headed in the future. How should genetic information be used? We aren't going to talk about it, but the whole question about databases, and the FBI will tell you it's been very effective in many cases and has led to some mistakes in others, but some very, very effective in finding criminals. You just simply, as a matter of routine, do genetic profiling. You have a crime, run the gene. You know, instead of getting a fingerprint, all you need is an eyelash or a piece of skin or a hair. Do the genetic profiling, you end up, there he is. You know, we know who it is. And in fact, the movie is, if you remember the movie, is based on the fact that the kid who is not genetically engineered ends up taking on the identity of someone who's engineered so that he can become an astronaut and fly to another planet, right? So the movie's about the unengineered making it anyway, despite the odds of this, you know. And what happens is there's a murderer in the in Nassau, right? And they do this big thing with the gene. They end up with one eyelash from his computer or from just laying around and identified that this guy, and they think he's the murderer. He's not. But think he's the murderer, and then the whole movie then is about trying to track him down based on this knowledge of his genetic profile. So what should we do with genetic information is the question there. After the screenings, you see we left two healthy boys, two healthy girls, naturally no critical predispositions to any major inherited diseases, naturally, right? Naturally. You don't even have to ask them for permission for that. Should we select or destroy viable embryos if they are carriers for one of the more 6,000 or so genetic diseases? What's the difference between genetic disease, disorder, trait, so on? In the film, there's this scene where, of course, boy meets girl. We'll talk about that on Friday, actually, in terms of dating and so on. But because she pulls out a hair of hers and you know, gives it to him and says, if you like what you see, you know, give me a call, basically. it's a great scene. We'll talk about that. Yeah. But in the film, there's a scene where they're dating and they're going to see this concert. Is this guy playing the piano, beautiful piece of piano. Everyone stands up and cheers, and he throws his glove off, and of course she catches it, and there's six fingers in it. He has 12 fingers. It's a piano piece that's written for someone who has 12 fingers. It can't be played by anyone else. He was engineered to play music this way, right? Harkens back to the old days in some ways of the castrados, right? They did work that showed, you know, they're castrated, right, when they're very, very young, so they would have this talent, this ability to do something, right? No one asked them about that, but so is polydactylism a disease? Is it a disorder? Is it a trait? Same with achondroplasia of height, and we'll talk about cases where people have come to genetic counselors. In the case we're going to look at for the deaf, the case on deafness, a deaf couple comes to a genetic counselor, and they want to find out if their fetus is going to be deaf or not. And the counselor is assuming that if it's deaf, they want to abort it. Not the case at all. They don't want to have a hearing fetus. They don't want to have a child who can hear. They want to make sure the fetus is deaf. Is deafness a disability, a disorder, a trait? Is deafness a culture that you want to make sure your kids are a part of? We're not going to have easy conversations this week. And we may end up not with so much truth as we have some insight. And that's a precursor, I hope, to truth is insight. Okay, so what are the implications of trait-based selective abortions for the current community of disabled persons? Adrienne Ash. Spent 2 weeks with Adrienne Ash in Dartmouth on an NIH conference there. She herself is a blind woman and bioethicist. And you know how sometimes you think you're liberal and you really are open and you have no prejudices, right? And you know you voted for Obama after all, right? And so on. And but I remember you know going to England the first time when I went there, getting off the plane and hearing a black person speaking with an English accent. So that, what? Why? How could that happen? You know, because it never dawned on me. It revealed something about myself that I didn't even know. You know, I had this, why, of course, why shouldn't they speak with an English accent, right? And same here with Adrienne Ash. I got in these really big semi-public fight arguments with her. You know, having come from England, you know, people tend to fight more freely there, and it doesn't mean the things it means here. You have a big fight and then have your arm in arm down at the pub. So I was kind of, then I realized I was fighting with a blind woman. And again, why should that bother me unless I had you know, some prejudice background there that I shouldn't be fighting with a blind person or a woman about you know something. So it was all in the background. But anyway, she has this argument. It's a very simple argument in some ways. And I'll just throw it out there whether you agree with it or not. She says, yeah, we should not do any prenatal testing, period. So, no, don't do it. You shouldn't do it. And her argument is just two things, basically. I'm greatly simplifying this, but her argument is two things. One, she says that that trait-based selective abortions based on genetic tests and so on, the message to the community of disabled is that if we could, we would live in a world without you the way that you are. And it goes to a fundamental assertion about our self-understanding as human beings that she opposes. Yeah.
There, as long as we're in Hollywood, there's a Star Trek episode that deals with this too, where they go.
Speak up a little bit, please.
There's a Star Trek episode that deals with the same thing. They land in some colony that has been doing all of this, and they supposedly have the smartest, most perfect people, and everyone has the perfect job that they were engineered to have. And the Star Trek crew comes there, and they're all, you know, naturally born people. And they tend to be more adept at fixing the problems. And it's a Gordy, you know, he's a blind guy, fixes something. And they're like, well, how can you be so good at this? Because you weren't even born to do this. And, you know, so it's that whole thing, like, well, you start trying to make it perfect, you screw it up because there's random mutations and things that you don't know were going to happen, and now you've prevented that.
And then that's a possible analysis of this direction that we're headed. You're right. And Adrian Ashe's argument is far deeper than just about the disabled, about the community of disabled persons. It's deeper than that, and it goes in that direction. I agree. And
all you have to do is take a dachshund and put it out in the wilderness, and you can see this is a mistake.
Well, I mean, the thing that her second point, by the way, which is this. Her second point is this, that she wants to say that it's a fundamental problem. That it reveals an assumption about being a parent that's completely false. She wants to say that to be a parent, that all this stuff does is do nothing but create people who are obsessing over every detail of health, as though health and we're somehow coterminous, right, with meaning, with the meaning in life. And we're going to talk about cases where kids, you know, with cystic fibrosis, they might die at 8 or 9 or years old, or someone with a heart condition might die at 30. What's the meaning of that life? You know, is there some number of years that you would have a cutoff, say, if you're only going to have 5 of them or 30 of them? There's no point in being born? Or something of that sort. So she's saying that, look, to be a parent does not mean to become preoccupied with preventing your kids from suffering. It's to find a way to love them, support them, be with them in the inevitable suffering, what it means to be human beings. That's, again, her argument. Argue with